Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the kind of, I suppose intellectual history is what you would call it. It's the development of right-wing thought in the Conservative Party from the 1950s onwards. I'm looking at Marching to the Fault Line by Francis Beckett and David Henk. But I'm speaking initially more from a bunch of the writing I did about 4 or 5 years ago when I was engaged in writing several books for the new history syllabus on modern British history. And there's a kind of a fascinating journey which almost takes us to the present moment when British politics is polarised so far to the right that the sorts of tropes, sorts of ideas that were considered to be verging on fascistic in the mid-1970s, the kinds of ideas that were put about by the National Front, are now being claimed by parties that have stood for election, and in fact actually the Conservative Party itself. And this is part of the kind of the UKIPisation of the Conservative Party since about 2015. But anyway, we get kind of ahead of ourselves. If we go back to the end of the Second World War and the defeat of the Conservative government by the Labour Party, the Labour Party's biggest kind of electoral victory before the governments of Tony Blair. The Labour Party proved to the Conservatives a salutary lesson, that the Conservative Party would have to accept the social contract, or the new social contract that was emerging after World War II. The Conservative governments before the Second World War had not been without their own efforts towards degrees of social reform. And in 1945, the manifesto that Winston Churchill's Conservatives put forward was not devoid of social reform. Indeed, it had a form of national health insurance, nothing where quite as comprehensive as the NHS when that emerged in 1948. But in 1947, the Conservatives, after having licked their wounds and reflected on the nature of their defeat, published a document called the Industrial Charter. And the Industrial Charter basically agreed to the following things. It said, you know, reluctantly we must accept nationalisation of railways, heavy industry, the things that Labour were nationalising, we must accept that the trade unions now have a much bigger role in the managing of the state, that they have been brought into mainstream politics, they've been brought into Downing Street in essence, and they're not going anywhere. We must also accept that there is an expanded welfare state and that the balance of things has tilted in the directions of social democracy. Now, the Conservatives won back power in 1951 and they continued to win until 1964, when Harold Wilson, Britain's most popular Labour politician, most successful Labour politician of the post-war era, returned Labour to office. But during that period of time, part of the Conservative appeal was this acceptance of a mixed economy, but also the Conservatives were lucky, fortunate enough, to experience an end to post-war austerity, the end to rationing, and the beginnings of a post-war boom that would last until the early 1970s. And so they had really the kind of the best of both worlds, as Harold Macmillan later said, you've never had it so good, or words to that effect. What he actually was signalling there was a kind of a word of caution of, you know, our people have never had it so good, and I hope in essence that they can deal with the social changes that are brought about by this newfound prosperity. But there was a branch of the Conservative Party that did not accept this new shift towards the political centre ground. Make no mistake, the Conservative Party was far from being anything approaching left-wing, and every concession towards shift towards the political soft left was done really as a result of the calculation of political realities, much as even those who were vehemently anti-Brexit after 2016, a great many voices were saying, well, you know, we have to accept and exist within these realities no matter what. So the key figure in the return of the Conservative Party to the economic and the economically liberal and the socially conservative is Margaret Thatcher from 1975 onwards, and she takes leadership of the Conservative Party, and obviously 1979. When she's in office. So, Francis Beckett and David Henke write, Margaret Thatcher and the philosophy she stood for did not spring on the world new minted in the 1970s. Hers was a strand of thinking in the Conservative Party which can be traced back at least as far as 1957, the first year of Harold Macmillan's premiership, when Peter Thornycroft resigned as Chancellor of the Exchequer, along with his financial secretary Enoch Powell and his economic secretary Nigel Birch. These three men stood for a new brand of conservatism, distinguished at first by their convictions that that money supply had to be controlled and inflation kept down with low-wage settlements, and the free market was the key to both prosperity and freedom itself. They had no patience with the patrician way in which Macmillan humoured and, in their eyes, appeased the unions, and regarded them as having a legitimate voice in the state. In future years, the battle lines lengthened to embrace the Atlantic Alliance and the European Union. So this was a key and interesting fact, is that the conservative right in the 1970s looked upon joining the European Economic Community as a good thing, and we'll come to later on as to why that kind of inverts itself. So, Thornycroft, Birch and Enoch Powell, whose famous racist anti-immigration Rivers of Blood speech in 1968 saw him as becoming, under Ted Heath, the outcast of the Conservative Party and the darling of the far right in Britain to this very day. The three of them believed that firstly, market forces needed to be allowed to operate in Britain once again. This isn't Thatcherism. This is comes 30 years beforehand. And that the trade unions were a big obstacle to that. The trade unions ensured that labour prices, wages remained artificially high, and if these could be brought down, then it would deal with the problem of unemployment. Now, here is where it all falls apart, because in 1957, there wasn't a problem with unemployment. The labour markets were straining to provide capital, provide industry with enough workers. By the early 1960s, it was common practice in manufacturing jobs to be able to walk out of a job on a Friday night if you didn't like the boss, and into a new job on Monday morning down at a similar factory down the road. The growth of the world economy in the post-war era, in the 50s and 60s, had been explosive. So there was the fear of relative economic decline. I stress the relative in relation to America's stratospheric growth and the emergence, with the re-emergence of countries like West Germany and Japan as economic powers following the devastation of World War II. But this is relative decline. Britain in 1957 doesn't have significant problems. There was often a lot of talk about strike days lost. The one newspaper that hated the trade unions and liked to present them as folk devils and liked to present them as enemies of competition and enemies of productivity was the Times newspaper. And 1957 was the year of a famous Alec Guinness film, I'm All Right, Jack, which was the most, I think, if I remember correctly, the most popular film of the year. And it presents, it's not Alec Guinness, I beg your pardon, it's Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers as a kind of an obtuse and difficult trade union shop steward who dreams of the wonders of the Soviet Union. It was part of a kind of like a popular mood of resentment against the trade unions. Even though, if you look at comparable strike days lost with most other first world countries, Britain is relatively minor in these stakes, and countries as far away as America and Japan have far more industrial action. Most of the European countries lose far more strike days than Great Britain. So, but there was a this kind of fringe of the Conservative Party that believed in restricting the money supply. This is a tenet of monetarism, which would later become what we would think of perhaps as neoliberalism, that inflation happens when there is too much money. And if there is inflation, then there will inevitably be unemployment. Inflation will erode savings, it will erode productivity, and it will put upward pressure on prices, and that will lead to eventually to redundancies and unemployment. In the early 1980s, Geoffrey Howe, Margaret Thatcher's Chancellor, explicitly on reading from Hayek and Milton Friedman, imposed monetarist policies on Great Britain, and this resulted in huge levels of unemployment. You restrict the money supply, you cut the level of state spending, you raise interest rates to suck money out of the economy like a sponge, and hey presto, you wind up with hardship, deprivation, and you wind up with bankruptcies and companies collapsing. But what Geoffrey Howe discovered, to his shock and horror, is that in addition to all of this, that inflation itself did not go down. So,
selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So you wound up with high unemployment and inflation. So whatever monetarism promised, it turned out that the thinking was wrong, and it really relates to how we see individuals in the economy and how we see them as consumers and producers and all this kind of thing. And they are evidently far less kind of homo economicus than we thought. Anyway, returning to the problems of Harold Macmillan in 1957 with Thornycroft, Powell and Birch, Francis Beckett and David Henke Wright. Macmillan won the first battle, riding with seemingly effortless ease the storm that Thornycroft, Powell and Birch hoped to whip up. But his protege, Edward Heath, lost the last battle, ejected from the leadership of his party by Margaret Thatcher in 1975, a year after losing the general election. Like all politicians who actually changed the world, such as the other great change maker of the 20th century, Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labour Party, the grocer's daughter from Grantham had very clear and precise ideas about how the country should be run. It is not government but free enterprise which is capable of creating wealth, providing jobs and raising living standards. So away with the strong public sector of the Attlee government, and in particular with nationalisation. Talking of herself and Ronald Reagan, she said, "Our belief in the virtues of hard work and enterprise led us to cut taxes. Our belief in private property led to the sale of state industries. Our belief in sound money led to the monetarist policy that attacked inflation. It could all hardly be clearer." So Margaret Thatcher kind of inherits the torch from the likes of Enoch Powell. Now, it's not to suggest that Margaret Thatcher particularly embraced the rivers of blood side of things. There were comments that she made in 1979 around immigration, and about being swamped and flooded and all this kind of stuff. But it was really a world away from the rivers of blood rhetoric. So she was economically on the same page as Powell. In terms of immigration, I would think that Mrs. Thatcher was probably largely indifferent to the debate. No doubt she would probably have used and did use the immigration and race relations card in all sorts of kind of reactionary ways when it suited her, but she was no ideologue when it came to race and identity. Margaret Thatcher was more focused on this question of the relationship between the state and the individual, the idea that individuals were the only real relationship was the relationship between individual and property. Margaret Thatcher in 1979 essentially overturns the post-war settlement that had lasted from 1945 onwards. That settlement itself had been breaking apart throughout the 1970s. The 1970s saw two oil shocks, one in 1973, one in 1979, which led to skyrocketing inflation. Social democracy in Great Britain seemed to be unable to survive these inflationary pressures. And the argument that Thatcher put forward was that some kind of wholesale root and branch institutional change needed to occur. Mrs. Thatcher in 1979 was not exactly the Margaret Thatcher you see later on in the mid-1980s. Her manifesto in 1979 really is about a return to law and order. The 1970s has seen an escalation in crime in Great Britain. Nothing compared to the upsurge of crime during the 1980s, actually. The 1980s is a very violent decade in Great Britain. But also, the 1980s was a decade in which there was an overall sense that the country was drifting towards anarchy. The trade union movement saw a decade of strikes across the country, and the fall of Edward Heath's government in 1974 at the hands of the miners. Edward Heath institutes a three-day week in which and power cuts occur because the National Union of Mine Workers are able to picket coal processing plants and essentially bring nuclear coal-fired power stations down to shutting down electricity output. And Ted Heath runs an election essentially on the question of who is in charge. And the answer is famously not you, mate. The Labour Party were re-elected. Harold Wilson, then increasingly tired and unwell, was re-elected, and it was on the assumption that Labour would be able to deal with the problem of the trade unions without waging all-out war upon them. Margaret Thatcher's principal problem with Edward Heath was that Edward Heath had created a manifesto called the Selsdon Park Manifesto. He and the cabinet in 1970, just before, or the shadow cabinet in the 1970, just before the 1970 general election, went to the Selsdon Park Hotel in Croydon and brainstormed a manifesto which was far more kind of to the likings of the conservative right. Once again, it talked about privatisation. It talked about tackling Britain's poor productivity and hinted that something would have to be done about trade union relations. And it was a manifesto which was perhaps a couple of steps short of what the ultimate expression of Thatcherism became. It was perhaps less kind of focused on kind of installing a kind of popular capitalism. It was more about shaking up the boardrooms of Britain and making a modern, more managerial capitalism. But definitely the taking on of the unions was in there, and doing something about curbing public spending, which is something that the Conservatives were obsessed with. Heath fails. He's elected on his manifesto, but he fails on almost every measure of it. And Thatcher in 1975, when Heath is defeated in 74, Thatcher launches a leadership challenge in 75, following the failure of Sir Keith Joseph to become the kind of the rights candidate to take on Heath. Keith Joseph had made some sort of eugenic-y sort of comments about single mothers, which even for the Tory right were a bit unacceptable. However, Keith Joseph himself, who had transitioned from being a kind of like a welfare Tory, a social reformer, to being the most kind of extreme and outspoken face of hacking back public spending, cutting welfare, and exposing the country to the rigours of free market capitalism. He was now persona non grata, and so Margaret Thatcher, Keith Joseph's protege, took up the banner against Heath and demanded that Heath be essentially deposed for not sticking to manifesto pledges regardless. And Mrs. Thatcher loved to think of herself as this figure who was a conviction politician, a confrontational politician, a politician that had the battles that she thought needed to be won. And as we start to look more closely, and this will be the subject of another podcast, at the miners' strike itself, this is the titanic battle that shapes Britain in the 1980s, and really has shaped Britain ever since, has led to the crippling of the trade union movement and the kind of the end of industrial Britain. We now exist in this kind of post-industrial landscape, which has arguably and yet to really kind of find its full expression. But it's certain to say that with the election of Margaret Thatcher and Margaret Thatcher's successive electoral victories throughout the 1980s, that the old world of consensus politicians such as Macmillan and Heath, but also the likes of Pryor and Whitelaw, who were unceremoniously turfed out of the cabinet during Thatcher's early years, that these figures were kind of consigned to the distant past of the Conservative Party and the right is in ascendance. In 2010, when David Cameron came to power on a policy platform economically more punitive probably than anything Mrs. Thatcher had proposed, yet culturally speaking the kind of the language of the Conservative base's bête noire, Tony Blair, he was always viewed with intense suspicion. And in some ways, the fact that from Heath onwards, you had career politicians like Margaret Thatcher, who were far more, not working class, but lower middle class in origin. The return of right-wing Etonians, whose economics are utterly ruthless, and yet who culturally represent a kind of a liberal metropolitan elite. Often this hasn't sat very well with the party base. But more on that next time. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this podcast and you found it useful, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Do check out the explaininghistory.org, subscribe to the newsletter, and there'll be updates galore. And also, if you can swing by our Facebook group, say hi, Explaining History Podcast Facebook group. It's welcome to you. There's always some cool content there. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.